Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking to the other side of the drug debate. I'm going to talk to a guy who has worked to shut down a safe injection site. His is not a perspective that I've had a lot of time for before today. You know, the NIMBY perspective, the not in my backyard perspective. These people just have so much less skin in the game than everybody else involved. But you can't say that about this guy.
I have a brother with schizophrenia who's lived on the streets for 17 years. He's free to live on the streets, and nobody's going to pick him up and put him in an asylum like we did back in 1890, but he's going to die out there.
Supposed to keep an open mind, supposed to always, you know, talk to the other side of the story, but you develop biases. There's no way around it. If you cover things, you feel a way about them after a while. And I've got mine. I have a bias about the opioid crisis. I think I came by it honestly. I didn't have any strong pre-existing feelings about, you know, the drug crisis until I started reading about how drug users are spoken of in the Canadian press. It's just gross. Like, over the years, there's like Rick Bell in the Calgary Sun calling drug users scumbags. Globe and Mail's Margaret Wente, who is questioning whether it's really worth saving their lives with naloxone when people OD. Mark Tuohy, Post-Media columnist. He wrote, there is zero point keeping people alive just to suffer in perpetual misery. You get a situation like the opioid crisis. Over 47,000 people have died from opioid toxicity between 2016 and March of this year. And the press, like from this position of power and comfort, actually writing that these people's lives are worthless. And, you know, it's evolved into this political thing. It's the politicization of whether or not to actually invest in keeping these people alive. We know how to keep them alive. I've been educated about this by Garth Mullins. You've heard him on the show before. He's the host of the excellent show Crackdown, and he's a drug user. And he told me what's really going on. What's really going on is that we know how to keep addicts alive. You give them drugs. But we have a stigma about that. We have a moral problem with just handing out hard narcotics to addicts because we consider it a moral failure that they are addicts, even though we know it's a health problem. It's a mental health problem. It's a public health crisis. But if you give them the drugs that they want, they will stay alive if they are given safe supply, if they are given safe injection sites where if they happen to overdose, they can be revived, they will stay alive. It works a lot better than rehab. We know that from the research. That's what I've been educated on over the years. And where it doesn't work, why it hasn't been working, is because we're not doing it right. We still have a stigma about giving people drugs like fentanyl or heroin. And so instead, people are given safe supply to drugs they don't want, that pharmaceutical companies want to sell them or sell the governments that hand them out. Hydromorphone and drugs that I guess are still very strong, but perhaps less euphoric and less fun. And so what happens is addicts who are addicted to one drug are given a drug that does not quite scratch that itch. And so they sell it or trade it. And that creates a market for drug dealers to come and give them fentanyl or heroin that in many cases is toxic. And for everybody around this, it creates criminal drug activity in the neighborhoods around these public health services, safe injection and safe supply. If we actually did this right, if we actually had enough safe injection sites, there are only 100 safe injection sites in the entire world. And 37 of them have been in Canada. But that's not nearly enough to get the research and the data to know if this works. If you're not going to do safe supply properly, and give people the right drugs, you don't know if it works. And so I've watched it get politicized, and I've watched Pierre Poilievre seize upon these very predictable negative consequences of doing it wrong and appeal to people's most base impulses. It looks awful. What's happening in downtown of our cities looks dangerous. Needles on the ground. And I throw up in my mouth a little bit when he pretends to care about these people, and that's why he's really going to invest in rehab. And I just don't believe that from the Conservative Party leader. I have my biases about this. I have my bias against Doug Ford when he announced that he's shutting down 10 of Ontario's 17 safe injection sites.
Well, you know something, I just don't believe these safe consumption sites. I've listened to the people in the neighborhoods, I've consulted with them, I've been getting endless phone calls about needles being in the parks, needles being by the schools and by the daycare. That's unacceptable. Giving someone, an addict, a place to do their injections, this was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's the worst thing that could ever happen to a community to have one of these safe injection sites in their neighborhood. And I was just wondering how you would feel if I stuck one of these beside your house. You wouldn't like it. Matter of fact, I know you wouldn't like it. Neither would your neighbors and neither would anyone else. And all the kids, they shouldn't be by schools. They shouldn't be by daycares. And then Leslieville, endless calls nonstop on my cell phone about thank you for doing this. And we are going to support these people that have issues and addictions. We're going to support them better than ever before.
So that was Ontario Premier Doug Ford thinking that he knows me, assuming that I would share his moral disgust because of a few needles. And I want to say to him when he says, how would you feel if I put it in your backyard? I want to say to him, man, bring it on. These people's lives are more important. But that's easy for me to say, because it's not in my backyard. My guest today is Derek Finkel. He's a journalist and an author, and he is a dad in a neighborhood where one of these centers was put in his backyard. One of his neighbors, a mom of two young kids, got shot. I've been reading Derek Finkel's articles in the National Post about the opioid crisis, and they've challenged my bias. And I've invited him here today to challenge my opinions about this in conversation. Wait for it.
It all began in this parkette next to the South Riverdale Community Health Center, a supervised safe injection site where three men were hanging out.
One guy came up to them, but they started chasing him right away. They got him on the ground, beating him, and he finally got away, got up and ran across the street. He turned around with a gun, and that's where the stray bullet hit that woman, I guess.
When police arrived, they treated a woman in her 40s with multiple gunshot wounds. She was rushed to hospital, where sadly she was pronounced dead. Now people here in Leslieville tell me the victim, who has yet to be identified by police, was a mother with school-aged children. So much sadness in this neighborhood and a place where everyone should feel safe.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jesse.
Derek, what happened in your neighborhood at the Riverdale Health Center?
South Riverdale Community Health Center opened an injection site, or sometimes called supervised consumption sites, in late 2017. There was no protest. There was nobody was up in arms about it. I think we all assumed that the drug using would happen inside the building and that it wouldn't really affect our neighborhood. We found out within, a year or so that we were incredibly wrong in assuming that this site wasn't going to cause problems, or that it was something that the health center was going to be able to manage. And things changed pretty quickly once the site was up and running. We started to see a lot of open use in the immediate vicinity of the site. We also started to see a lot more needles around, not just on the perimeter of the site, but in, within 100 to 200 meters of the site. It was starting to get more and more problematic. There are two elementary schools there. There's now six daycare facilities within 150 meters of the site. We also started to see assaults. There was verbal threats. We started to see psychosis. Crime started to, especially theft, started to really increase. And I myself had an episode where it finally kind of came to a head. I mean, I had minor dealings where I would find, you know, needles on my son's hockey net, like in our backyard and that kind of thing. And I would bring them to the center and say, hey, what gives? In the spring of 2021, which was, you know, a year into the pandemic, and obviously things got worse during the pandemic for a number of reasons, but the area outside the center started to really get chaotic and out of control, especially considering that there are 100 children who live on my street. It's a one block street, and most of them go to the local public school, Moore Street Junior Public School, which is literally across the street from the health center, or less than 100 meters from the health center. And one day I was following two approximately 8-year-old girls who were walking together beside the health center. And I was behind them. I was maybe like 10, 15 feet behind them. I didn't know them. And as they turn the corner, there's a little parquet between the health center and there's a Presbyterian church. There's a little green area.
Mm-hmm.
And that had basically become, by 2021, an open-air drug market, you know, for use and drug dealers. And these two girls came around the corner and they suddenly stopped in their tracks. And there was a man and a woman who were basically in a fist fight, barely able to stand. And then there were two men, grown men, leaning against the health center wall with tourniquets around their arms, and they were shooting up. And these 2 8-year-old girls were, you know, I don't know if they lived on my street. I didn't recognize them, but I basically had to escort them to where they were going to get them on their way. They were both pretty shaken up. They didn't really know what to do, like to stop, turn around, keep going. So I just got them on their way. And then I went into the health center and I was pretty enraged because this had been going on for a while. And when I went in and I said I wanted to speak to the manager of the supervised injection site, I was told she wasn't there. She was working out of Toronto East General. I ended up having a phone conversation with her. But it's worth noting that when I went in, every time I went in to the health center to talk about this activity that was going on, that especially wasn't appropriate for children, I was always given the same answer, the same lecture, which is that, you know, this should be a teachable moment for your children. And, you know, this is how, you know, you should be, you know, parenting. And at this time, when they said that to me, I finally said, you know, this isn't a teachable moment. This is a terrifying moment. And, you know, we've had children had beer cans thrown at their head. We've had children in the backs of cars just driving home and had people attack the cars. We had one neighbor, somebody came out high from the center, walked down our street and threatened to burn a woman's house down with her children in the house. It became very clear that the center had very little control over what was going on around it. And I'll just end this part by saying that I did end up speaking on the phone for an hour to the person who was in charge of the site at that time. You know, she tried to beg it off on what was going on with respect to the pandemic and that society's most vulnerable were feeling it the most. And I once again felt this sort of patronizing sort of lecture from this person. And I just said, you know, society's most vulnerable are the children in my neighborhood. There's 100 of them on my street. They can't go to school. They can't use splash pads. These lanes behind our houses, which back onto this, your mismanaged health center, your injection site, they're spilling into our lanes. Like, we had children literally having to ride their bikes around prostrate, unconscious bodies and people, you know, injecting into their arms. And I begged her at that time. I said, you know, I don't understand how this can exist without security around the building. Like, how can you have us, you know, all these schools and daycares right there, and then you have basically a drug emporium happening on the exterior of your building? And she just said, well, there's no budget for security. And I'll just end by saying that they finally found budget for security on July 7th of 2023, within a couple hours of a local mother in our neighborhood being shot and killed during a dispute between three drug dealers outside of the injection site. That's when they got security. They found the budget after the shooting.
I feel like you buried the lead there. Somebody got killed. What can you tell me about that?
In the weeks leading up to the shooting, I finally started to connect with many of my neighbors. We became so sort of concerned about what was going on around the site. And for several years, we realized that the health center was not really responding to our concerns. So we finally decided to embark on our own research project, and we, as a community, collected data about the number of instances of, you know, needles, open use, violence, drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera. And we compiled those statistics, and we finally arranged for a meeting with the CEO of the health center in late June, so just a couple of weeks before the shooting. The parents who were representing the different streets in our neighborhood who were in the meeting were pretty upset. And one of them said, you know, I don't know what it's going to take for you guys to do something. That does a child have to get killed or seriously injured? And then, you know, 3 days later, I was up in Northern Ontario taking my son on a fishing trip. And I was getting calls from reporters at the Toronto Star and elsewhere about this shooting. And I just went back to what happened in that meeting and what was said. And it didn't turn out to be a child that was injured. It was the mother of two young children, a 44-year-old local mother. Three drug dealers got into a gunfight and killed. Her name was Carolina Huebner-Macarat.
She was an innocent bystander just walking down the street.
Correct. She was getting a smoothie at lunchtime.
And there was some kind of altercation between three suspected drug dealers, I guess?
The police have made it known that they were drug dealers. Their working theory is that, based on the video and so forth, is that two of them tried to rob the third one, and that's what, well, of drugs or money, and that's why the guns got pulled and fired.
I'm really glad to speak with you because I have opinions about this. I'm not an active player in any of these issues. It's just something that I've had conversations on the show about, and I formed opinions about them. And as it's become such a political issue, such a controversial issue, such a divisive issue, I think I've probably gotten dug in over the years. I've gotten a little bit cynical about it because I see what Pierre Poilievre is doing and the way that he is using people's disgust with what's happening to a lot of downtowns in Canada to present a case for his campaign. And I don't believe him when he says that he's got a better plan for the welfare of these actual people. I have my biases with this. And I've spoken to Garth Mullins, who hosts a show called Crackdown.
I know who Garth Mullins is.
And I guess he was an activist, but also a storyteller and a journalist of sorts, an interesting kind of journalist who's, I think, done incredible work telling some of these stories. When I've read contradictory pieces or coverage or journalism that's challenging these centers, I'm often suspicious of it because of how politicized it is and because it's become such a conservative talking point. What you've written is from such a personal perspective, and I've got some things in common with you. I'm a dad in downtown Toronto, and it drew such a stark contrast between what I'd like to think I believe and what I might believe if I were in your shoes. Let me go on a little bit, because what I want you to do is help me to challenge my opinions on this, which I think is a healthy thing to do. In general, I feel like if you decide to live and raise kids in the downtown of a city, you are opting in to live amongst all kinds of people. And
I agree.
You do have teachable moments. You are not cloistering your kids off from the world. And I have had uncomfortable and awkward moments where I've had to explain to a kid that person has some kind of mental health problem, or that's some violence we're seeing there, that's poverty. And these are disturbing moments, but they are part of our world. And I don't have a greater claim to these streets, to these neighborhoods, than my neighbors. And there's all sorts of different social services, and my neighborhood has lots of different types of people living in it, but nothing like what you described. And I guess what reading your work challenged me to consider is, would I think very differently about these issues if it was in my backyard? So I want to understand where you have arrived. Are you against these centers?
I agree with the vast majority of everything you just said, okay? I've lived downtown my entire adult life. And yes, I agree. There are certain expected behaviors. There are people with schizophrenia. I have a brother with schizophrenia who's lived on the streets for 17 years. I'm acutely aware that we need to take care of people who in some respects can't
each
take
other.
Care of themselves.
Take care of each other.
Yes.
I'll also assume you got people in your life with drug problems.
Yeah, one of my best friends growing up died of an accidental overdose caused by fentanyl 2 years ago. I put him in the ground with my own hands. I'm very aware of the crisis. It's touched me. I'm very aware of mental health issues, certainly in the city. But that doesn't change certain facts, okay? These sites, and a lot of people, if you don't live near one, what you don't understand is that safe supply and injection sites are two different things. When people come to an injection site, they don't get the drugs there. There's a pharmacy right across from the injection site. Clients in the safe supply program were going to the pharmacy, filling their prescription for, 30 pills of 8-milligram hydromorphone, which is a pharmaceutical opioid, very, very strong. And then they were meeting, and we all know that the cars that the drug dealers were driving because we saw them every day, and were meeting and essentially trading their prescription pills for either, foil, fentanyl, or in some cases cash. But usually it was for street fentanyl, because street fentanyl is many, 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 many times more powerful. Yeah. They're purchasing the drugs. It's street drugs. And primarily nowadays, it's fentanyl. And so the people who use these sites rely on street dealers to get their drugs, okay? And one inevitability or an inevitable consequence of these sites, especially in a downtown area like Leslieville or South Riverdale, is that what you get is the site also dispenses needles. People call it a needle exchange. It's not a needle exchange. There's no exchanging. The needles only go out one way. There's no obligation to return them, okay? And because there's needles being distributed there, and because the drug dealers inevitably flock to the site, a lot of the activists, if you bring up the fact that drug dealers are required for this service,
nobody can inject in a safe injection site, right, unless they have something to inject, and they're correct, not getting it from the pharmacy.
Correct. And so what this site ends up, what ended up happening was drug dealers ended up encircling this site. And because, and I've been on television programs where I've been debating, like the executive director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. If you talk about drug dealers outside the site, they say, well, it's just a service. Like, if somebody was shot outside of a mall, would you close the mall down? If somebody was shot outside a hospital, would you close the hospital down? And a lot of what I will have to say is this kind of stuff is infuriating. There's a lot of these faulty comparisons going on. When Doug Ford introduced beer and wine and so forth into convenience stores recently, a lot of the harm reduction activists were outraged because, they literally, in all seriousness, compare, bartenders to street fentanyl dealers who are packing heat sometimes. And it's outrageous. Speaking of Pierre Poilievre, I mean, I don't need Pierre Poilievre or any politician to tell me what it's like to raise a family across the street from an injection site. I don't really care what Pierre Poilievre says. And I don't really care at this point what Justin Trudeau says either. All I know is that I live across the street from this place that requires drug dealers, okay, in order for the service to be provided. All right. And nobody wants to acknowledge that. And when you bring it up, they give you these, crazy comparisons about hospitals and malls. And they say, it's just a service. It's just a service. Well, it's not just a service.
I think I can hear your frustration. And I can appreciate your frustration given the story you just told me. It seemed like, I think that people with your point of view have been treated shabbily and dismissed in a way that I think is not really humane. Even the term NIMBY is like, there is, these are rich assholes who think that all of society needs to protect their kids from the harsh realities of the world. And meanwhile, these vulnerable people are dying. You quote this in your reporting. Your neighbors, who I think have pretty reasonable concerns, described as opportunistic opponents of a public health program who are trying to exploit the public's grief to undermine the hard-won shift in support for these services. What do activists do? This isn't an insult. They have an agenda. And I think that this conflict has made you the enemy of their agenda, and discrediting and vilifying your enemy that's an unfortunate part of politics. So I guess I'm hoping that we can have a conversation that's different than that.
Sure.
Because I still don't know what you think should be done, and I'm not sure about the way you describe it. Let me share with you my understanding of this based on the coverage I've done in the past. And I hope I'm not misrepresenting other people's point of view who are advocates of this stuff. I'm sure it's more detailed than this, but in general, Garth Mullins also is critical of these sites. Safe supply and harm reduction and safe injection advocates are critical of the way this has happened. And the point of view that's been shared with me is There are not enough of these things. We've only done a series of little experiments, so we can't say how effective they are.
A lot of, you know, Garth Melnick, we didn't scale it up, right? We didn't have enough of them. I mean, first of all, I don't believe, having lived through what I've lived through, I don't think bricks and mortar injection sites are actually the way to go in most communities. I think other than areas where there's a really acute problem, such as, you know, East Side, Vancouver, downtown East Side, I think, you know, because otherwise you'll just end up with this really concentrated problem. And speaking of which, all of these studies into supervised injection sites around the world, there's tunnel vision. It's all about the clients. One of the reviews done of South Riverdale by a supervisor appointed by the province who wrote a review, like a 40-page review of the place, one of the things that she noted in the review was that there's a dearth of studies on, you know, what are the impacts that these places have on neighborhoods.
Yeah, but we're moving all around the place. I mean, I think reasonable people would say that all of these people matter. Everybody matters here. But it's not just like...
Yeah, but I'm talking about the impact. The people impacted the most are the people who live in close proximity to these places. So, you know...
Well, no. And this isn't just some study. These are stats from Health Canada.
No. I'm talking... Between
January 2017 and May 2024, there were over almost 5 million visits to safe injection sites, almost 500,000 unique clients, and 58,000 plus non-fatal overdoses. The fact that 58,000 people who have drug addictions such that they will overdose, they will take too much fentanyl, take too much heroin, and they will overdose, and 58,000 times they did so in a place where their lives were saved, is not insignificant.
It's not insignificant. No, it's not insignificant, but if you want to get into numbers, some other numbers I would throw at you is that between 2020 and 2022, 89% of the overdose fatalities in Toronto were people who had previously been hospitalized for mental health afflictions, issues. Okay.
What do you make of that?
I would also point to a study that was done. It's online. People can read it. It was done by UBC. It's called the Hotel Study. It was a 10-year analysis of the intersection between mental health disorders and substance use disorders, and it had about 400 participants, and it spanned 10 years, okay? And 95% of the participants had a substance use disorder, 84% had a mental illness, and almost 50% of them, they all were given MRIs and brain scans. Almost 50% of them had brain damage. So what I'm saying is that South Riverdale, there is no on-site psychiatric mental health care, okay? The way I see this crisis,
these are people with mental health issues who are self-medicating.
And we have no facility, no plan, no infrastructure to address that.
Like, I think that some people might be confused into thinking that we're having an argument.
No, we're not.
I'm not sure that we are. I want to get some clarity here because I think that we could shout statistics at each other. I think there's some pretty compelling research around some positive impacts of, I mean, they're different things, but Safe Supply has its own research. And then there's research around safe injection sites. Rather than fight about the warring research there, one thing that I hope we could agree on is that the polyev concept, that what these people need is rehab and treatment, the stats are pretty conclusive there. Those are failed approaches. Diverting everybody to rehab and treatment, the relapse rate, the death rates are terrible. The idea that that's the solution to the drug crisis to me just seems like it's so blithe. And what really lies behind it, I think, is just that this is not a prime minister, if he becomes one, who is going to actually fund enough beds of rehab and treatment to deal with this problem. There's no conservative agenda to like quadruple the amount of money we put into giving people free rehab in this country. What this is about is bulldozing these people out of sight and out of mind. And if they die, let them not die in front of me. And that's where it gets heated for me, is because I think that he's pretending to care about people. He doesn't. And I don't see them as a lower class of people or a different class of people, because there's people I know. I'm sorry to get on this tangent. What I think maybe we even, you tell me, if these facilities did not exist in areas with as many families and kids as yours, if there were adequate numbers of these facilities, so it didn't all focus on one place, and very importantly, if addicts could get the drugs that they are addicted to, and they didn't have to go and sell them to illegal dealers for more strong narcotics that were maybe toxic and tainted. They didn't have to have street fights over the drugs. Nobody was there with a gun because there was no trade for illegal narcotics because